This is an ABC podcast.
It's been an interesting summer, hasn't it? Around Australia, we've been watching the heads of the various fire services giving us regular updates on the monster fires that have scorched the country over the past few months and left us with a sense of dread and grief. Those who have been watching the updates from the New South Wales Rural Fire Service cannot have failed to notice the Auslan interpreter with the big bushy beard, an animated face and kind eyes. Sean Sweeney can hear, but he identifies as deaf. He was born with perfect hearing into a deaf family, and he learnt sign language before he could talk. Sean grew up in that community, and it's got its own language and culture. He left it for a while in his 20s, but when he came back, he discovered that his Auslan was actually pretty good, and so he decided to use his superpowers for niceness. Hello, Sean.
G'day, Richard.
When the bushfire crisis broke out in December 2019,
yep.
What were you doing when the call came?
I was actually getting ready to go on holidays, and I got the phone call, you know, after 6 p.m. and I was downstairs looking at my boat and I was, you know, just tinkering, you know what you do, you just tinker around the boat getting ready, and I was thinking, beauty, I'm going away. And I get this phone call and I was like, oh, you need an interpreter for tomorrow. And I questioned him. I said, oh, what happened? Like, why are you calling me? And he goes, oh, well, I need an interpreter for tomorrow. Are you available? And I went, yeah, I'll definitely available, definitely. And that's how I got the call.
How about the family? Were they?
Oh, my wife looked at me and went, no, we're going on holidays. And she gave me that wife look. I don't know whether all you married men out there have got a wife look, but I got one. And I looked at her and I said, come on, it's important. I need to do this. And she just looked at me, rolled her eyes and went, okay, then no problems. And she goes, we need to have a holiday later on. And I said, yeah, no worries. I promise you we'll have a break.
So, Sean, what happened when you walked into the headquarters of the RFS?
I walked into the headquarters. What happened? That's a good question. I'd never been exposed to any sort of media stuff before. First time in my life. And I met the head of the media team that was at the RFS. And he sort of went, yep, you're standing over there, do this, do that, do that. I went, oh, okay then, no problem. So I was very nervous, I suppose, very sheepish. I was sort of being pushed into the corner and stood over here. And I was like, okay, cool, no worries, I can do that. And then I saw all these cameras and I thought, wow, this is serious. And then I started to think to myself, okay, Sean the interpreter, how am I going to interpret this language to target the deaf community on, you know, from the 10-year-old, well, really from the 5-year-old deaf person to the 80-year-old deaf person. So I had to really deliver a message without leaving deaf people out. So, because every generation's got their own sort of understanding of sign language. Not everybody gets exposed to sign language in a generational sense, you know, with parents who could sign, influence people and understand. You know, as you raise a child, when you speak to a child, they learn from you. They learn their language because you're using, you know, speech. So sign language is very different. So most deaf kids grow up in a family of hearing people and they use sign language only at school but not at home.
So you've got to essentially in that situation communicate really important and complex things but in the clearest form of language, the clearest, most cut-through, direct language that a kid of 5 and an older person can understand.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got to paint the picture. It's black and white, and then I colour it in.
When I've done events with Auslan interpreters in the past, I'll have a little chat with them beforehand and just have a chat about what I'm going to talk and about. You'll be talking about something that's specific that might have a bit of jargon in it.
And you
need to have that conversation with an expert.
Absolutely. Look, what we like to do is always, in a perfect world, we'd walk in with prep. We'd walk in with all the list of jargon, you know, all the different wording, you know, understanding what the message is. In a perfect world, that's what we always hope for, but we don't generally get that. What I did for myself, walking to the RFS, I listened to the radio station, I looked at all the apps, I looked at all the news channels, I looked at all the different weather conditions. I completely did my research before I walked in.
Right, you had to become an amateur meteorologist before you walk in to some degree.
Yeah.
And so were you going around asking people questions? I mean, because not everyone's going, hey, everyone, let's brief the Auslan guy, are they?
No, they don't. They don't. Until you start talking to people and asking for information. That's how you get your information. You generally got to go around hunting for it until they understand how to work with it with an Auslan interpreter. It was interesting. The first couple of broadcasts that I did, And remember, like, the only reason why I'm in this position today is because of the deaf community. The only reason why I'm talking to you is because of the deaf community. And I just really want to acknowledge that. You know, I was there doing a job and that was it. And for me to be sitting here opposite you is, it's sort of taken me back a little bit, you know, at the same time. I want to explain to people how important interpreters, we, Auslan interpreters, are a vital part of the community for communication. So, yeah, so when I walked into that room, that's what I had to do, was really connect with people and teach people how to work with me.
Be there with for your community that you're representing there.
Absolutely.
There are moments in those broadcasts where the head of the New South Wales RFS, Shane Fitzsimmons, was getting quite emotional at times. Do you then reflect that in the way you sign?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And how? How do you do
just
that?
Just through expression, just through, you know, when you're sad, you've got to look sad, don't you? I mean, you know, if you're happy and pulling a sad face, that's not going to work. So, you know, if I'm interpreting sadness, I've got to show sadness through my expression. So, and sometimes I take it on too much and I end up having the lump in my throat, which is, that happens a lot more than what, you know, people realise.
How far back does deafness go?
In my family?
In your family.
3 generations. So I'm a 67 baby. So you've got to think, you know, my mum, her mother, back to her mother. And so there's a direct line. It goes right back to 1890 where, you know, we got deafness in our family. And my great-grandparents were deaf and they were Victorian deaf people. And they were big advocates in the Victorian deaf community many, 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 many years ago. And then they had 2 deaf children, my uncle Eric and my nan. And then my nan had 3 deaf kids, which is my mum, my auntie and uncle, and my grandfather, of course, Pop.
so there's this, it's deeply, on your mum's side, it's deeply immersed in going way back for
absolutely.
For nearly a century or something?
Oh, geez, it'd be pretty close, wouldn't it? Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And how about on your dad's side, though?
Well, dad's a good Irish Catholic. He grew up in Ireland. He went to an all-deaf school in Ireland. There was 900 deaf boys. We're talking back in the 40s and 50s. And so he acquired his language. He was really fortunate because he went to a boarding school. So he had language and people around him who he could learn from, like older kids, priests who could sign, teachers that could sign. So language for my father was all about the sign language.
And how did your parents meet then?
Well, Mum travelled around the world back in the 60s.
Was that seen as adventurous back then for deaf people to do that?
That's funny because I never looked at it as adventurous. I went, that's what mums do. They just go and travel. I didn't think of the deafness. It never occurred to me until people started bringing things up like, wow, that's adventurous for a deaf person.
Well, because like, for a very long time, we always try to cotton wool people
absolutely.
Who are deaf or blind or the like.
Yeah. Well, from my point of view, no. Mm. Maybe from your point of view, yes. But Mum went, I'm travelling around the world. And she travelled around the world for 3 years back in the 60s and met Dad in England. And voila, here I am.
So were your parents surprised when baby Sean, when you were born, that you could hear? Was that surprising to them?
Were they surprised? I think.
I mean, is it common for hearing kids to be born to deaf parents?
Yes, it is. Right. Yes, it is. Yeah, very common. Very common. Was Mum surprised? Possibly. Dad was dad. Oh, yeah, no worries. I've got a son. All done. Beauty. You know.
So what is it like then being a hearing kid growing up in a deaf community?
Well, for me, I don't know any difference. But if you want me to make comparisons, I grew up in a community where spoken language wasn't our first language. I grew up in the community where sign language was, and it's a different culture. It's a community that has grown over the last century to where it is today.
How does it affect, like, when, you know, kids are noisy by and large, aren't they? But I don't suppose that's a thing, is it, if you're in the deaf community?
No. Noise was, I was never told to be quiet. I was never, like, you know how mums and dads go, shut up. And I never got that. So what we used to get is if we're on a wooden floor and I ran through the house on a wooden floor, then I'd hear Mum go, stop running. And she would shout out in her deaf accent, stop running. And I'm like, oh, Mum felt us run through the hallway. So that's
loud. Right.
Yeah. So that's loud. But as in noise around the home, we were never told to be quiet. So me, my sister, and my brother would know the restriction on noise.
Is it a bit like being the son of migrant parents insofar? And as such, are you sometimes like a go-between between your parents and the hearing world?
As kids, my sister did mainly all of that. I used to run away. I used to go, no thanks. And, you know, I was that typical boy, went and played soccer every weekend, took off on my push bike in the morning. You wouldn't see me back until the afternoon. So I was a very adventurous young boy. I mean, I grew up in Western Sydney. Western Sydney in my day was just bushland and it was beautiful. And I was really fortunate. But my sister did a lot of that stuff. So mum used to drag her in.
So, Sean, you could sign before you could speak. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. So my first sign was bottle. I asked mum that. I said, what was my first sign? She said, bottle. And I went, oh, wow, how young was I? She goes, about 9, 10 months. I went, oh, really? So,
what, yeah. Doing it in, like, not just acting it out, but actually doing sign?
Yeah. I'd ask mum for the bottle.
Right.
Yeah.
I just, that's got to be a whole area of study of what it means to have a kid have a language before before it's spoken. You know, because when you speak, then you get the grammar.
That's right.
Over time. So you're communicating effectively with your parents. In a very early age.
Yeah.
So how did you learn spoken English then?
Well, like every other kid, I just went to school, watched TV, because I remember getting that little black and white TV, Neighbours, things like that. So as a kid, from a really early age, I got this memory of living with my grandparents in a granny flat out the back with mum and dad. And I used to ride my little tricycle down the street and down the driveway because that was a big, massive driveway. My grandfather was a very handy man. So I used to always sit with my grandfather and I'd always talk to him as a 5-year-old. So and it's funny because now looking back, I was exposed to my grandfather's generation's language. And so I got his input, plus my dad's and plus my uncle, who was deaf as well. So all the deaf men in my family were all my mentors. With language.
How about there was a deaf club in Stanmore when you were growing up. How important was that for you as a kid?
Vital. It was the heartbeat. It was the heartbeat of the Sydney deaf community. The deaf community used to meet there every Friday night. It was a ritual. I used to come home from school. Mum used to drag us all in. We used to all get washed. We'd wear...
Nice clothes.
It was the same clothes. We'd even have the same patterns and whatever. Anyhow.
Well, you were matching kids, were you?
Yeah, I've just had a flashback then. And then we get dragged off to the deaf club. And it's funny because in the old days, I got this memory of traveling to the deaf club in a little Datsun 1200cc and going down Parramatta Road and just feeling the bumps in Parramatta Road because we used to always drive to Stanmore. So because it used to finish late at night and then we used to come home. But the deaf club, amazing. We used to walk into the deaf club and there'd be, this is through children's eyes, I reckon probably close to 300 deaf people all just mingling, catching up. Because what deaf people did back in those days, they didn't have SMS, Facebook, they didn't have access to media. They instantly, like we do today. So as my dad would always say, today's deaf kids don't know how to be deaf. Because, I know.
It's too easy.
It's too easy for them.
So is there a sense of like a real deep relaxation then when you're amongst your own people deep comfort, like putting on an old boot, that kind of thing?
Yeah, 100%. So, and today I'm at my most comfortable when I'm surrounded by the people in my community.
How does it look, I suppose, to someone who can speak or someone who's not familiar with the deaf community? Do you look on at a deaf party like that, which is a really lively party where everyone's having a great time and very relaxed and amongst old friends and communicating and telling jokes, but would it look odd to the rest of the world, like looking at something on behalf of us, like in a soundproof screen or something like that?
Yeah, look, when the deaf community get together, they really get together and they socialise and exchange information and
like
chat.
Anyone else does, yeah.
Just it's huge and it's really safe. It's for me, it was always safe as a kid growing up. So that's what I got to experience.
Were there variations of sign language in Australia when you were growing up?
Yeah, there's a northern dialect and a southern dialect.
Get out. Really?
Yeah.
What, like state of origin or something?
I'll tell you what, if you're going to do a comparison, state of origin's brilliant.
Right.
And I think you'd have to be either a New South Welshman or a Queenslander to understand that rivalry.
Right.
But we've got that very similar rivalry between Melbourne and Sydney.
Right, so like, it's more like an AFL, NRL sort of line then, in that sense.
Yeah, that's probably a good description.
And what are they, like dialects, or are they just a bit different? Is it like...
It's a dialect. Well, they actually say there's a northern and southern dialect. And I mean, I'm not a linguist, so but you know, I leave that to the experts. There's an actual dialect, and for me, it's funny because my grandmother was from Melbourne, and my grandfather was from Sydney. So I got exposed to both dialects as a kid, and plus my mum and my brother. I mean, my mum, my uncle, and my auntie all grew up and went to school in Sydney, and they all went to the deaf school at Darlington. Okay, so that was a cultural school. And so I was influenced from my grandmother's side, which was the southern dialect, and also the northern side of the language, and the northern dialect. So I was very mixed.
It's just weirdly like football. I mean, you know, the reason why we rugby league in Australia is because of the Catholic Brothers that came and introduced it, you know.
Yes.
It's, it's not that different at all in that way.
Exactly.
So with that difference, is there like a class issue with those differences too? Is one a bit more upper class, a bit snootier than the other one, and one a bit more rustic? Is that how it goes?
I'd rather leave that.
Okay, all right. Okay, that's it.
I'll leave that to the deaf community to deal with, because it's interesting. When you go to the Melbourne community, they say things about Sydney deaf,
right,
and vice versa, but it's fun.
And how about words? Are they sort of like embarrassing and awkward sort of misunderstandings that can arise from these different dialects, like different words for different signs for different things?
There could be. We've got one where it's hungry, you know, there's one sign hungry, and there's a different sign which means it could be used as horny, sexy, sex. Something along those lines.
Are you saying people from Sydney and Melbourne could confuse hungry with horny?
Yeah, they could, yeah, they could. They could. But, I mean, it doesn't happen today because of the exposure within the language now. It did back in the old days, like in the 70s.
So what's your accent? If there's, is it our dialect? Is it?
Well, it's funny because my dad from Ireland, like I'd mentioned earlier, he uses a different sign language.
Oh.
He uses Irish Sign Language, which is a one-handed sign language. In Australia, we use two hands to communicate with. So our roots come from England. I don't know whether it's some sort of religion influence going back hundreds of years, but the Catholics all seem to use one-handed sign language. And this might sound really weird, but the English use two-handed sign language. So I don't know the histories or the origins of that, but that's what I grew up with, my dad's influence as well. So my language, I can switch between the two dialects, no problems whatsoever, but then I can do one-handed sign language with my dad. So
you're like someone who can speak French fluently, but also speak Italian and Spanish?
Not quite
like that?
No, not quite. Right. No, the differences within the northern and southern is, you know, it's not that bad. You can generally get it. Once you've been exposed to it, you sort of go, well, what's that sign? And then you work it out and then you hang on to it. But my dad's Irish sign language is completely different. Yeah, that'd be like, you know, an Australian trying to learn French.
Are they sort of slowly being obliterated, those differences, over time?
Yes, and I think all sorts of languages get influences from all over the world, especially with the internet. We're getting so much exposure in Australia to New Zealand sign language, American sign language, British sign language, European sign language, and all these different sign languages done around the world are now all over the net. They're all over the YouTube. So young deaf kids are growing up going, oh, this is a sign language I use at home, but I can get exposure to these languages because I'm watching it on the internet. So, and then what ends up happening is that there might be one sign in another language that might influence the Australian sign language like English does. And then all of a sudden we start using their hand shape and their movement in our language, and we've adopted their sign. Yeah.
I can't read it, but when I see someone like you performing and other people doing interpreting, there's a grace to it at times. And there's an elegance. There seems to be a grace to it, and it seems to have a poetry to it. Is that right?
Oh, look, when it's done properly, it's beautiful. It is such a beautiful language. And to be able to communicate using body language without not even using your voice is an amazing skill on its own. And to get it meaning and expression just through body language, like seriously, how beautiful is that? When you look at it and you think, wow, they can communicate without even talking to each other, that's amazing. And when it's done properly, nothing beats it. I'm telling you, nothing beats it. And if you understand it, it's just beautiful on the eyes. It really is.
Yeah, it is. It looks like it's like dance mixed with something else performance. I mean, there's a performance in speaking, I suppose. I'm just thinking through as I'm going. There should be down in flames here, but there's a bit of performance in speaking, but there's so much performance in Auslan.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, that's the language. That's how we express ourselves. That's how we communicate, is through expression. So if we don't do that, you know, they're the, like, the building blocks of the language, the expressiveness, the movement, the hand shapes, the facial, like, it all comes together. It's like within the English world, you've got nouns and verbs and particular structures. We've got exactly the same equivalents in our language. It just works.
I know the things aren't analogous. They're not the same thing by any means. But people I've spoken to on the program who are blind, it's a different thing once again. But they often find that they need to be, when they go into social situations, they need to be extroverted.
Yeah, of course.
Even if they're not personally extroverts, they find that they need to put people at ease, get everyone to calm down and just get them to react to a normal, like a normal human being.
Yes.
Do deaf people have the same issues? And and how do they deal with that?
It's interesting you should say that. Similar issues, similar. What ends up happening is it becomes too hard for a lot of people. They think, oh, it's too hard to communicate with that deaf person. But all it takes is, you know, one gesture, one hand movement, you know, using the visual tools or aids that are around you to get your message across to a deaf person. And that deaf person, they've grown up knowing how to communicate with the wider community. They know what you need to know for them to get their message across. It's the disability really lies with the person who doesn't understand them, because they're the ones that are struggling. So they're the ones that are going to end up turning around and walking away from the conversation. Well,
that's what I mean. I mean, that's the thing. Very often people who have and I know deafness isn't really seen as a disability.
Yeah, that's right.
But nonetheless, in those situations, you're always dealing with the anxiety of the person from the rest of the community.
Of course.
That lands upon that person like a burden to them.
Yeah.
So you've got to massage these
absolutely
these situations.
Watching my family and friends walk into that predicament, they generally find an ally they can communicate with, and generally they just hanging out with particular people at a barbecue, for example, and they just talk to them. They usually respond to how the crowd is. If the crowd's got a really good attitude, the deaf person should be fine. But that's like any situation, really. But isolation is the biggest issue for deaf people when they walk into an environment where nobody can communicate with them, and it's generally the people within that environment feel nervous about creating that communication.
Also nervous at excluding someone, because that's just bad manners to do that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. What's the best way to go about that then? Do you have
just
advice?
Just say hi. Just say hi. And if you show through your attitude that you're willing to try, a deaf person will communicate with you, no problems whatsoever. That's all you got to do is take that one step.
How good at lip reading are most deaf
people? They're good at saying, you know, I love you, because they saw that from their mum and dad all their lives. You know, things like common words they can generally pick up on. But you've got to remember, the best lip readers in the world only understand 30% of what's actually being said.
30%?
Yes, and they're the top lip readers. So what they're doing, they're filling in the jigsaw puzzle. So, you know, when you're putting a puzzle together, when you get the coffee table out and you tip out the pieces and you push all the pieces aside, and then you create that space in the middle of the puzzle pieces, and then eventually you build the puzzle. Well, that's what deaf people deal with every single day. They've got to grab the piece of the puzzle and try and fill in that puzzle. So they might get you pointing at a box and go, oh, they're talking about a box. Okay, they've got the puzzle of the box. What size is it? Oh, okay, he's gestured it's a big box or a small box. They get the other puzzle. Oh, hang on, I just saw on his lips he said something. Oh, yeah, I know what that word is. Grab that word. So what they do, they put the pieces in the puzzle. So when they walk into an environment with no sign language, that's what they deal with every single day, is that they're looking for puzzle pieces to put together to understand what's going on around them.
It can sort of lead you into thinking as a person with hearing, talking to a deaf person. I've had that in the past. The deaf person can be quite charismatic, because they're really looking at you.
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
Really looking at you.
Absolutely.
And hanging on every word you say in a way that of course might seem, you know, flattering, but in fact it's just they're just doing their best to understand what you're trying to say.
Absolutely. Look, eye gaze is a really big part of the language.
And does that create a kind of a profound sense of intimacy within the deaf community?
Oh, that's an interesting question.
I mean, don't you find when you're not talking to deaf people, communicating with deaf people, you know, people will be looking off in the distance or over your shoulder or not paying you quite the same amount of attention as you normally would?
Look, when within the community, when people are communicating, there's a lot of eye contact, and when you got that connection, intimacy, I suppose there is, because when you're talking with somebody, you're delivering the meaning, you're getting your message across, so straight away you got a connection. And when there's understanding, and understanding is empowerment, and when it's just fun to be able to communicate with people and be comfortable.
There's a concept that's being talked about increasingly called deaf heart. What does that mean to you?
Deaf heart. For example, I've got a bunch of deaf mates, and they're all deaf coders. And what coder means is children of deaf adults. And we all go fishing with each other. Once we do one weekend a year, and we all got a little WhatsApp group, and we all go bang, 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 bang. We go away fishing, and it's just the boys. And we got four deaf guys who have got deaf parents, and we got four hearing guys who have got deaf parents as well. And so what we do, we all come together, and that's an amazing weekend. And a lot of this is a real big thing in the male part of the community. In Sydney, I'm only talking from a Sydney point of view, there's a sign where you put your two fingers onto your ear, and that means deaf, and then you put the finger on your heart. And hence that means those two fingers goes onto your heart. So a lot of my friends used to always come up to me and say, man, you've got a deaf heart. And I go, yeah. And that just means that I'm culturally aware of what their needs are and I connect with them. And I'm really proud of that.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
As a young guy, Sean, you turned your back on the deaf community
for a
while.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
How old were you? Is this like your 20s or something?
No, I was a lot younger than that. I would have probably 15, 16 years old.
What were you thinking at the time?
It's interesting. What was I thinking at the time? I didn't have a connection. I didn't. I'll admit that. I didn't have a connection. I went on a bit of a journey myself and I didn't really connect with anybody. And it wasn't until I came back in my early 30s that when I say I didn't connect with anybody, I mean, I connected with the community that I was in, but I was missing. There was something missing within my spirit, I suppose. And it was a little hole that was never filled. What happened is that I ran into an old deaf friend. And I was like, oh, and she was like, oh, my God, Sean, I haven't seen you for so long. And I'm like, yeah. She goes, but your sign language. And I remember thinking to her, saying, well, I can't sign that well. And this is what I used to say to her. Oh, that was crazy, I know. It's every time I think about it, I just shrug my shoulders and shake my head. I'd never really understood my own language from a detailed point of view. And I didn't really understand that the community had recognized themselves. Because what had happened is during this time frame that I'd sort of, you know, I just sort of moved into another direction, that the deaf community was going through a phase in the 80s where they got the language recognised, and then all of a sudden deaf rights became deaf people had the right to do this and had the right to do that.
Because the assumption was for a long while that every deaf person wants to hear, and
yeah,
that was
right.
The assumption. And came as quite a shock to a lot of people to hear that. A lot of deaf people are happy being deaf and wanted to remain deaf.
Yeah, exactly. And that's quite common. That's really common. And it's only the parents of the deaf child that fought. Not force, I shouldn't use that word. They make a decision that they feel is right for their deaf children.
And so all this has been going on while you were away.
Yeah, so I went on this journey. I went down a different path. Well, it wasn't a journey. Well, it's a chapter in my life. And I went down a different path, and I loved the people around me and what have you. And
maybe that's jump in. Maybe that's just because you grow up in a kind of a really, like, I think maybe anyone who grows up in a very powerful culture, sometimes you need to walk away to come back to it or something.
Yeah, look, at the time I didn't think it was powerful. I didn't know it was powerful because it was just the norm for me. And because I didn't have a connection with anybody, nobody really explained to me that we actually use a different language and we do things differently. We're culturally different. And I never got that explained to me. And so I didn't really identify as I was just Sean. And so I now identify myself as a coder, which is a child of a deaf adult. And my mates always say, you know, you got a deaf heart, but that's different. That's just a mate thing, I suppose you could call it. And, but within the community, I'm classed as a coder. So they always say to me, oh, you're a coder.
Child of deaf adult.
Yeah, right. Spot on. And I go, yeah, mum and dad are deaf. So that's how I normally react. And then you get the nod of, oh, well, that's why. And they always give you that nod of, oh, my God, you signed so well. And that's why, because your parents are deaf. So that's the sort of response you get.
Did it mean you had to leave your family behind for a while?
Step away from them? I didn't make the effort to go and see them. I just didn't. I didn't make the effort. I didn't go and talk to them. It was my own thing. And I saw them at Christmas time, but I was really in, out, gone.
Was it someone who encouraged you to go back?
Well, what had happened is that when I was doing a little bit of soul searching in my early 30s, I went back to the community. And then when I ran into my deaf friend who said, well, why don't you become an interpreter? I scoffed and I said to her, no, I don't want to become an interpreter. And I got made redundant at that time I got redundancy, and I was sitting there and I was really confused as to what to do for work. And I thought to myself, well, maybe I could sign. And this is what I was thinking.
So when you ran into your friend who was signing to you, she went, oh, you're signing. She wasn't saying your signing's terrible. Was she saying your signing's really good?
Yeah. And she was a bit blown away because I hadn't seen her for so long. And I didn't know that I could sign that well until people were telling me, oh my God, Sean. And I was like, what do you mean?
Was it like speaking the Queen's English or something, is it? A bit like that.
Yeah, exactly. And
what, you speak Auslan with a cut glass accent, do you?
Yeah. exactly. So my exposure to the deaf community was quite overwhelming when I first came back because I'd really thrown myself back into the community. I started working at Granville TAFE, which is pretty much the hub of the deaf. Because if you go west, where the big portion of the deaf community is, Granville's a real central space for deaf people to jump on trains and buses to get their, you know, further education. So they'd go to TAFE to get educated in all different types of fields. And so I found myself working there, which was great, but it was fantastic at the time. But now, you know, I've been in the industry 20 years. Every time I reflect on that time frame when I started off as an interpreter, I was like, wow, they just threw us in the deep end with no supports. But
so what kind of work were you doing as an interpreter at that time?
Mainly education, right. Working in the education area. And then I moved on. So
what does that mean, just being in a classroom?
Yeah, in a classroom, interpreting the teacher to the student. So there'll be a deaf student in the classroom. And then I would interpret what the hearing teacher was saying. For example, carpentry. There might have been a deaf apprentice or somebody doing a computer course or somebody, you know, learning to become a draftsman. So I used to sit in those sort of courses and interpret what the teachers were saying.
How hard is that? Because they've all got areas
really,
of expertise.
Really hard.
And technical terms and jargon and all those sort of things.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Do you have a way of making jargon in Auslan?
Yeah, you do. If you're in a special classroom. Not a special class, like in a classroom where, you know, you've got one deaf student who's going to become a carpenter, you end up developing signs with him and saying, oh, look, what about this particular joint here? Do you want to make a sign for that? Because there's no sign for it. And he would say, yeah. I said, unless we met another deaf carpenter who'd been a carpenter for 30 years, he would have a sign for it, but I wouldn't know it because I haven't been exposed to it.
So you're coining new words all the time, aren't
you? Yeah, in the education area.
Yeah.
Look, new words always come into the language like in any spoken language. New words, like Google, for example. Google wasn't around in our spoken language until the last, 25 years? I don't know.
Twenty years, however long
Google. Now, and all of a sudden, you say Google, and everybody knows what Google is. It's a word that we all use in common language. And we've got the sign for Google, and we've also got which is a new sign, which is Google, which is the eyes Googling on the internet. So you've got a particular way of signing Google. And so language always evolves with every generation and every bit of exposure that you receive.
So after that, you then trained as an interpreter at the same TAFE?
What happened is that because at that time, you didn't need to be qualified. And so they would just bring in coders and say, look, can you work with, you know, the deaf student? So coders like myself who really didn't understand interpreting, we knew how to sign socially and communicate socially in, you know, different sort of scenarios, but interpreting is a completely different skill.
In what way?
Well, it's like, you know, you're at home. I'll use this as an example. You're at home on the computer, you're doing all your computer work. You sort of understand the computer, but can you fix one?
No.
So you need to be trained in that, don't you? So sign language, I can communicate using sign language, blah, 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 blah. But did I understand how to actually go from Auslan to English and then English to Auslan? So I had to go and learn how to do that.
Does that mean you have to have a kind of a two-track mind? Do you need to be able to think two things, these two tracks running in your head?
Yes.
Your English track and then your Auslan track.
Yes. So what ends up happening in the brain? I love analysing my brain. Sometimes I just think my brain is just, you know, it's just out there. But what ends up happening, sometimes when I'm in the zone signing and I'm listening to the speaker, whoever the speaker is, I can hear what's being said. I can process the information. I don't know. Is there parts of the brain? There must be. So I go, I listen with my whatever side the speaker's on. I listen. Let's say he's on my right-hand side. So I listen to my I'm listening away. And at the same time, my left side of the brain is processing the information. And then I'm telling myself, okay, this is how I'm going to deliver it. So I make sure that the deaf person knows what's going on. So, but then every now and then I'll listen, I'll deliver it. And then all of a sudden I go, I missed it. And then what ends up happening is, while I'm listening, that bit I've missed
yeah.
somewhere disappears into the brain. Yeah. And then all of a sudden I'll be delivering and then I'll go, oh, that's right. I left that bit out. And then I pick that up and then I throw it in later on in the language, because our language is so different to English that we can insert meaning further down the track, but we have to unpack it differently.
About a year ago, I was in China on a book tour,
yep.
and it meant I was doing events for Chinese audiences and bookshops, mm-hmm. and I had a translator sitting next to me.
Yes.
And it was a lovely experience, because I would say something, a couple of sentences, and I'd pause and let him translate.
Yes.
And in that time, I had time to think and reflect and come up with the next thing.
Yep.
You're not doing that.
Nah.
It's all on the fly for you.
Yeah,
you're talking while someone else is talking.
Yeah.
That, I don't know how you do that.
Yeah, look, that's lots of training, lots of learning. This is years and years of learning. To learn to become an interpreter, you're taught how to listen, how to work on time lag, how to reproduce, and it's all learnt. Anyone can do it.
Is the grammar similar to English?
No, in a nutshell. It's completely different. It's completely different grammar. Our verbs and stuff are different, and the way we deliver things, it's really hard. I'm not a linguist. You need to get somebody in who's really smart at that.
Well, English is pretty arcane. It's actually, it's this sort of hodgepodge of this and that that's accreted over the centuries from this and that.
Yeah.
Is Auslan more like, I don't know, Indonesian or Chinese? Does it sort of run along on rails a bit better than
look,
English?
Yeah, look, I've heard people say to me, the common thing that I hear amongst the, you know, the interpreters of the world, they always say that, you know, sign language has got its own grammar structure and it's all different, and it's very similar to a lot of different languages like French, and it's for some reasons the verbs and the nouns are around the different ways, and you know, we don't usually finish off a sentence, we do it the other way around. There's a whole structure around it. And
so if I said I saw a man walking down the street, How would that translate? Is that the word I'm looking for? How would you frame that? Would you be the I saw a man walking down the street?
No. You go, man, I saw him walk street.
Right.
I think I just did that in Auslan. Without even thinking, oh my gosh.
Tell me how you met your wife, Shavoy.
Oh, my wife. She's lovely. She's brilliant. She was my teacher. She did the workshop that I went to, and it sort of progressed from there. And then her story is incredible. Like she grew up next door to a deaf family. And when I say deaf family, I mean mum and dad are deaf. Both kids are hearing. Both kids can sign. And they were the same age as my wife. So she got to know them. They went to the same church. And so she learned how to sign from the mother. So she met this family when she was about 8 years old. God, I hope I'm right. When she was about 8 years old. So she learnt the alphabet, and she got the, you know, at the time there was what they called a signed English dictionary. And so she learnt sign English, which was put out by the education department, which is in Auslan. It's a different sort of way to communicate. And so she opened up this signed English dictionary and started learning with her sister. And the pair of them just learnt how to sign and using sign English. And plus she grew up next door to this couple who could use sign language. So she got exposed to it as a very young woman. And then she became an interpreter. I think she was 19 years old when she became an interpreter. And so she was an interpreter for many, many years. And then I met her around about, you know, I was 30, 33, 34, something like that. And then I met her. But she's an amazing woman. She's teaches a lot of interpreters. Her passion's the deaf community. And she's also got a deaf son. She's
got a deaf son.
Yeah, my stepson's deaf. And
what are the odds?
Yeah, I know.
Hang on. She grew up next to a deaf family.
Yeah.
And then decided, got interested in the culture.
Yeah, and learnt the language, learnt the culture, became an interpreter, went and worked at the local university in Brisbane as an interpreter.
And then happens.
At 26, gave birth to a deaf son.
Wow.
Yeah. And he's now in his early 20s. And her journey from Queensland to Sydney is because she went looking for the best deaf school at that time. And that's the whole reason why she moved from Brisbane to Sydney and put her son into Thomas Patterson School out at North Rocks.
Did you flirt with her in Auslan?
Did I flirt with her in Iceland? No, I didn't. She actually thought I was a bit of a jerk.
That's off on the way. Nonetheless, can you flirt in Iceland?
Oh, yes, most definitely.
How? It's all facial expressions?
It's all, well, I mean, how do you flirt without talking to somebody?
No, well, there smiling
you go.
A lot.
There you go. That's how you flirt.
Acting in a really ingratiating way, which just seems creepy most of the time to people, but that's it.
Yeah, so it's very similar. Very
can,
similar.
Can the language itself be flirty? I mean, is there innuendo, double entendres?
I would imagine so. Right. I would imagine so, yeah. Look, I've never needed to flirt with the language because I just haven't. But I'm assuming, for example, my cousin, who's a year younger than I am, her and her husband, they're both deaf. And I would imagine that he's a really good guy. And I would imagine that he would flirt with her through using sign language.
Wow. Actually like to watch. That'd be amazing to observe. What do you speak at home?
It depends on what mood I'm in.
Really?
Yes. And my wife says to me, she goes, I know when Sean's angry. Oh, not to me. When she's telling the story and I listen to her at the barbecue. And she goes, I know when Sean's pissed off because he runs out of English and starts signing at me.
So signing is a quicker way for get from here to there then, is it?
Well, it depends on what you're talking about. It's like any language. If with spoken languages, there might be two words used in Japanese where you might need 10 words to unpack that two meaning, those two words in Japanese, and vice versa. It's the same in Auslan. We might have one sign, but in English, it might take 10 words to explain. Or we might have, you know, one or two English words, which we really need to unpack the meaning to get that meaning across. Does that make sense?
It does.
Yeah.
As an interpreter, you're often called in to very important situations because where comprehension's very, very critical.
Yeah, it is.
So does that mean your job's often quite emotional like that? You're often brought into situations where there's a critical conversation that has to be had?
Yeah. Definitely. You know, some interpreters get exposed to some amazing positive moments and some really horrible moments. You know, we're working with a community. We're working with a community. And like every community, there's negatives and positives. And interpreters, we get sent into the world of the deaf community and we have to interpret whatever they're trying to get their message across and whatever their final outcome. So we could end up in a police station. We could end up at a wedding. We could end up in a christening. We could end up in a conference.
Doctor surgery, solicitor's rooms,
etc. For whatever daily appointments that we take for granted without an interpreter, a deaf person is always forward planning. Okay, I need to make sure I get an interpreter to come with me to the doctors or to go talk to the solicitor or talk to the real estate agent or et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. I mean, your job's quite emotionally intense then, doesn't it?
It can be. It can be extremely draining. And that's why the holidays that I was planning to take over Christmas was I was really looking forward to, which my wife was really looking forward to. But we stopped because it's a no-brainer.
Has deaf culture changed and does Auslan change with generations?
Yes.
In what ways?
That's an easy. Well, simply the fact that the language influences. There's a lot more English exposure now because deaf people have got not full access. They've got more access to captioning. And so therefore they're seeing the English word. So that's really important for information and knowledge and learning, as where my father's generation didn't have captions on the TV. Didn't have access to anything except the next day's newspaper. So the information that we used to get on the radio instantly, Dad used to always have to wait till the next day. And I remember Dad saying to me once, which I never really understood at the time, but I get it now. He goes, I'm always the last one to find out. And I looked at him and I remember going, well, I was a young boy, you know, and like I would look at him and shrug my shoulders and go, and what's the problem with that? But now, as an adult, I know that people want to know now. They, you know, they've got the right to know now. And the expectation is that we expect to know as a wider community. And if we don't know, we all, you know, we kick up a stink and we go, why? And we ask the question, why? Deaf people have put up with not knowing straight away their whole lives. And then when they ask the question, why, people go, oh, that deaf person's bothering me about it. But yet, when we ask why, we expect it. So the deaf person's always the second person that finds out. which is what we're trying to eliminate by making sure we got interpreters on the screen for emergency evacuations, for example.
How good is the broadcast media getting at including Auslan interpreters on screen?
How good are they?
Come on. No, seriously. I mean, I see it on ABC stuff. Yeah. I don't know if we're consistent with that or not.
Yeah, look, I think it comes back to the person pressing the buttons. Because when I had the conversation with the cameraman in the RFS, they all would say to me, we're told what we have to zoom in or, you know, zoom out to include the
guy in the firebox, the producer.
Is that what they're called? I don't know.
But they're making that call. How's commercial media, for example, at including the Auslan interpreter? Like, I've seen a lot of footage of Shane Fitzsimmons talking, and you're cut out of the shot.
Yeah. Well, it's really disappointing. It's really disappointing for them to make that decision and say, we don't have to worry about that part of the community and push them out of the picture completely.
Because there's a social license that operates for these broadcasters too.
Absolutely.
And us as well.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because I'll give you a beautiful story. My dad's 78 years old. Hang on. Geez, I hope I'm right. Yeah, he's about 78 years old. He's a full-blown deaf man. He's what I call monolingual. He loves his language. He loves who he is. He's a really positive human being. He doesn't use Facebook. He hates the captions because they're always 10 seconds behind. He gets really frustrated when he's watching the news and he doesn't know what's going on. For him, having the interpreter on the screen saves my 78-year-old dad. He lives in Kalala Bay. He was actually in the path of the fires, right? And I was freaking out hard. And then to hear stories where they were cutting me out of the picture, it just, oh, my God.
Sean, it's been completely amazing speaking with you and taking us into this world, this life of people who live alongside us and amongst the rest of us all the time. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much, Sean.
Not a problem. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.